From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, June 19th is the Buddhist Asalha Puja Day. Thursday brings the Rastafarian celebration of the birthday of Emperor Haile Selassie. And Friday is Pioneer Day for Mormons. Sunday is observed as Father's Day in the United States, so I want to wish a very happy Father's Day to all of the dads, grandfathers, and stepfathers listening to our show today. Even as the story of the mass murderer who took 49 lives at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, has taken a number of unexpected twists and turns, most reactions have been completely predictable. Long entrenched in our ideological silos, we seem to have lost our capacity to process and react to devastating events in any way but the most political of ways. Congress has redemonstrated its utter deadlock on gun control. Anti-Islam activists have focused exclusively on the shooter's ethnic origin and nominal religious affiliation. Some voices have heartlessly dismissed the tragedy as impacting, quote, only gay people. A perceptive journalist for The Washington Post wrote this past Monday, "When tragedy hits Americans, they stand divided. It's a sad truth. Look around and listen. The tragedy in Florida was awful enough. The tragedy of the aftermath is that rather than making an effort towards seeking solutions together, we seem to be able to do nothing more than dividing ourselves even further. And that includes following political leaders who thrive on just such divisions. Yes. When tragedy hits, Americans stand divided." It's been a week now since those shots rang out in Orlando. The breaking news has broken, and a lot of analysis of the case has taken place. Our focus on this show, this week, cannot hope to be all-inclusive, and we can't hope to arrive at global solutions. But what we can do is look at the tragedy from several specific and, I think, important angles. Look, this isn't easy because inevitably someone will feel mischaracterized. It's not surprising that long-suffering Muslim Americans want no part of yet another act of violence. Mental health advocates would prefer the focus to be on guns and ideology. Some LGBT leaders have urged that the focus be turned away from any potential internal conflicts the shooter may have had regarding sexuality. So we go into this knowing we're not going to be able to satisfy all agendas. But the thing is, overarching these disparate themes is what increasingly resembles the utter death of civility and mutuality in our society. Anyone we disagree with becomes an enemy, not just to be argued with, but to be destroyed. Honest differences of opinion somehow turn into hate. And so, great as the Orlando tragedy was and continues to be for victims and loved ones, the tragedy of what is happening to us as a people is even greater. Because if violence is the only remaining resolution to conflicts, whether external or internal, we are all in the crosshairs, because we will each be in conflict with agendas, ideologies, and campaigns sooner or later. There are political conventions coming up that terrify people who are in the know. What will participants who feel wronged, and no matter what happens, some will feel wronged, do to express their outrage? You know, we seem to have lost our faith in our structures of government. Worse, we seem to have lost our faith in each other. On this week's show, I'll talk with one leader who's working at the intersection of LGBT rights and Islam, an intersection that many people see as a dead end, but which Ilana Alizeh, founder of Muslims Against Homophobia and LGBT Hate, has staked out as her own. You'll also meet Catherine Boyle, founder of Outside In Ministries, whose work centers around equipping communities of faith to be welcoming and supportive of people with mental health issues. But first, a longtime leader and advocate for LGBT inclusivity in religious life, as well as a man who has faced death threats and worse as a result of his ministry. The Right Reverend Bishop Gene Robinson was the first openly gay person to serve as a bishop in the Episcopal Church, and he brings a perspective to this story that few others can offer. Gene, I really wanted to talk with you on the air this week, and I thank you for juggling your schedule to make that possible. Our conversations on and off the air now span almost two decades. We've talked in good times and bad times, sometimes laughing, sometimes holding back tears, sometimes baffled, sometimes angry. But with you, and probably more with you than with me, in all of these times, you have been hopeful. Hopeful, actually. And this is one of the bad times and sad times. And we need your voice, your thoughts, your faith, and your vision. And I can't thank you enough for being with us. Welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks so much, Welton. It's always a great pleasure to be with you, but especially at this really difficult time.
Gene, as tragic as the attack on the gay nightclub in Orlando was, has it been even more horrific because this happened during Pride Month? I know that's something you must have thought about.
I was going to write a piece for the Daily Beast about Pride, and to ask the question quite openly, you know, do we need Pride Month? Do we need Pride Week or weekend or Pride Parade anymore? Have we long passed the time when that's really necessary? And so at our Pride Parade here in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, I asked the question of a wide range of people attending what Pride meant to them. It was very interesting that the younger the person was that I asked, the more likely they were to say, oh, this is a party. This is a chance for us just to get together and be who we are, and isn't it great? The older the person was that I asked, the more I heard a political message and also a more somber message, which is, why is it that we don't seem to know our own history? Why is it that during the celebration of Pride, no one seems to remember the difficult journey it took, the dangerous journey it took to get where we are today. And they were sort of rueing the fact that our younger LGBT people just don't seem to be aware of or to remember or to honor the difficult road that has gotten us where we are. And then, of course, I wake up Sunday morning to this horrific news, and I wished that I could interview all of those same people on Sunday to see how their feelings about Pride changed from Saturday to Sunday. And my guess is that those who only saw Pride as a party we're in a very much more somber place and understanding that this fight isn't over and the hatred against us has not ended, and that part of being resilient in the present is remembering our past.
Mm-hmm. Florida, far away, a gay bar, people different from me. I suspect these are things that a lot of people probably found themselves thinking, and I think it's vitally important to break through that detaching, distancing defense mechanism. Gene, you personally have survived death threats and worse. I wonder if you would be willing to talk about what that was like and the lasting impact of encountering that kind of hate.
You know, I always call it incoming hate. It's like missiles that get fired against you, and it causes you to be ever on the alert. And in some sense, it means that there is a constant tension in your life. You don't take anything for granted, and you try to be ready for something awful coming your way, which, oddly enough, is why gay bars for the LGBT community have been places of refuge, right? We can't even go home to our parents, usually. We are often rejected by them or thrown out of what we used to call home. And so we, over the last 50 years, have sought out safe places where, at least for a few moments, you can let go of all that tension, that you can expect this to be a place where you don't have to worry about the incoming hate.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a kind of desecration of that safe place in this Orlando shooting, and it's such a vivid and horrifying reminder that our safe places are few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy for those of us who live in a very LGBT accepting and affirming bubble to forget that that is not true all over the United States. Mm-hmm. And certainly not true in the world.
Yeah.
And so the thing that I take from this is there is a threat even to those few safe spaces that we have where we can set aside that tension and just relax for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
and take a deep breath and cherish the moment without worrying about those incoming missiles with hate warheads, if you please.
Gene, when you were in the middle of all of that, how clear was it to you that the anti-gay rhetoric that is so common in parts of our culture played a role in somehow making it okay to target people like you? But where does the permission for killing a person because of sexual orientation, where does that come from?
Well, you know, I get that we have to be careful about drawing lines and asserting cause and effect,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean,
right.
That's a very complicated and complex process. But I think we are kidding ourselves as religious people, especially if we are people of one of the three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. We have built right into our sacred texts all the permission a shooter needs to mow down 50 people. It's right there in our text. And for instance, one of the things that I think is so disingenuous of the conservative religious right is that they are very happy to quote Leviticus to us about a man not lying with a man as with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But they're smart enough to know not to say the next sentence, which is, they must be put to death. They don't say that because they know that people would be horrified by that. But that's what the next sentence says. And so for Jews and Christians, Leviticus has it, Islam has it, and someone wanting to commit this kind of a heinous hate crime, all they have to do is read their scriptures, and they find all of the permission they need, and then those passions get fueled by the rhetoric that we hear from the religious right,
mm-hmm.
about how horrible, how disgusting, how despicable LGBT people are. Every time there is a bathroom bill against transgender people, it's just another cue to people that we are expendable, that shooting us is probably a good thing in God's eyes, and you'll probably be rewarded for it. I think if we underestimate the power of our scriptures and our own rhetoric to encourage this kind of behavior, to create the space for it to happen, and to fuel the passions that are behind it, I think we are deluding ourselves. It's long past time that we take responsibility for our scriptures and for our own rhetoric.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. Do you see a connection between the ever-growing trend of dehumanizing the other, of making mortal enemies of people we disagree with, and this kind of deadly violence?
Absolutely. The only thing I would add is that it's nothing new. In fact, it's very, very old. We see this throughout history where we come up with some sort of a rationale to dehumanize the other. And once that person or that group is dehumanized, then you can pretty much do anything to them that you want to. We don't have to look any further than the Holocaust for that, right? It began with the dehumanization of Jews and gypsies and homosexuals as well. And once you dehumanize them, then death camps are actually pretty easy to think through and to implement. And once you dehumanize gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender people, and there are countless ways that that happens, then if you're somewhat unstable, as this man, this shooter in Orlando seemed to be, it's really a very, very small step to wholesale slaughter.
I realize we inevitably find ourselves walking the thin line between analysis and speculation, but you've spent a lifetime at the intersection of LGBT identity and organized religion. So if a man like the Orlando shooter finds himself in a struggle between questions about his own sexuality and relentless anti-gay messages, combined with mental instability, how likely do you think that goes a long way toward understanding what happened last Sunday morning?
This was perhaps the most surprising thing to me and to many of us in the LGBT community. You know, the violence against us is nothing new. They've been killing us since time immemorial for centuries. And they're still trying to kill us. So that part of it is not new. Mm-hmm. But when it was revealed that many people in this club knew this guy from his having been at this club many times over a series of years, there was just a gigantic thud in my heart when I heard that. Because the other thing that the gay community knows is that the first loathing you have to get over as a gay or lesbian, bisexual or transgender person is the self-loathing that we have been taught to feel. I mean, we have learned from our religion all the things that everyone else has learned, which is that we are an abomination in God's eyes. And so we have had to go through the process of understanding that God loves us, God values us, and that God's love for us is beyond anything we can imagine. This man, if in fact he was in this club that often over that period of time, suggests that he himself was struggling with his own self-loathing. Mm-hmm. And what we in the LGBT community knows, or anyone who has a small amount of psychological knowledge, knows that what you do when there is something about yourself that you cannot embrace, that you want to run from, the typical thing you do is you project it onto someone else, and then you kill it as a way of trying to kill it in yourself. And frankly, if that turns out to be true, I mean, I think his 911 call claiming allegiance to ISIS was literally trying to throw us off the trail from understanding that he himself was struggling with his own sexual identity. And he wanted to be remembered as a martyr and as a hero, not as a gay man who was so self-loathing that he killed and wounded 100 people who turn out to be in his own community. How blood-curdling is that?
Gene, we've seen and heard diverse reactions to this tragedy. What have been your feelings as you've watched different reactions to the tragedy?
It's hard to find the words to adequately express how much it means to us to have these expressions of sympathy and support. When you look at an event like this, there's kind of nothing you can say. But when people show up at a candlelight vigil, it says through their actions what people can't find the words to say, which is, we stand with you. And I think what it means is that more and more people are realizing that the only way we really put a stop to this is not only to stand with the LGBT community, but to stand up for them. We will know that we are making progress when we stop laughing at gay jokes, when we stop believing the stereotypes, when we call people out on their anti-gay feeling. I mean, you know, there was a time in the 60s in the great civil rights movement for African Americans that people actually stopped joining country clubs that wouldn't let Jews and blacks in.
Right.
And we need to get to that place in America that more and more people, a majority of people, are simply unwilling to participate in life with people who have that kind of hatred in their hearts. And this is all complicated, of course, for religious people, because we do have these texts of terror that are used against us. And we have whole denominations of people who officially condemn us. Last night on TV, I'm watching a couple of independent church pastors saying what a good thing it was for 50 of us to be killed in Orlando, because after all, we're all pedophiles. It's just too bad that 100 or 200 or 500 weren't killed.
Yeah.
That's being actually said.
Yeah.
Over the airwaves and on YouTube and in countless places. When are we going to stop pussyfooting around about this kind of hatred? As religious people, it seems to me that we follow a Savior who stood up against injustice and was willing to take the consequences.
Right. My experience over the last few days has been that a lot of people, both gay and straight, are having trouble knowing what their feelings are about this. And I'm interested in knowing what you will write in your journal or the notes that you will make to come back and look at it again when you reflect on what has happened so far this week.
You know, I think the best advice I could give both my own community and the world right now is, I think we need to be kind to ourselves. And we need to give ourselves time to understand what has happened to us and what it means. You know, we live in a 24-hour news cycle, and people want answers right now. It's going to take a while to absorb the enormity of this and the meaning of it. It's going to take a while to figure out what was happening and why, and how religion is a part of it, and how our commitment to the common good is missing. And I mean, there are just all kinds of avenues to follow. And so, you know, I think what I'm trying to do for myself, and what I think would be good advice for anyone else, is take your time and resist the deep desire to have all this anxiety go away. And sometimes we avoid the anxiety by rushing to a conclusion or rushing to an opinion or rushing to an explanation, because once we've explained it, then we don't have to think about it anymore. And what we need to do is to think about this a lot. And so I expect to feel differently about all this tomorrow and even more differently the next day and the next day and the next. This is going to take a while. And as a culture, we cannot let this go with today's news cycle. We have to sit with it and think about it and pray about it for a good while before we're going to be able to get our arms and our hearts and our minds around it. But I think that is the only way we're actually going to benefit from this experience and do what God is always capable of doing, which is bringing something very, very good out of something very, very awful. That is the story of the crucifixion and the resurrection, that God can always, always bring something good out of something terrible.
Gene, are there any final thoughts you want to share that I haven't got to by asking you the right question or pushing you in a direction? Are we leaving out anything you want to say?
You know, your questions have been great, and like I say, I think maybe tomorrow, different questions, different answers. But for today, I think what I would end by saying is don't underestimate the importance and the power of your standing with us in this terrible time. I, for one, just like feel on the edge. I am teary half of the day. It takes almost nothing to start me crying again. Mm-hmm. And so seeing and hearing people standing with us, not worrying about the saying the right thing, just standing with us, mm-hmm, in this terrible time, saying the words gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender, saying gay bar, saying people of color, saying Latino and Latina, it means you're standing with us in this hour of need. And I just I cannot say strongly enough how important that is and how much it means to us.
Gene, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. This one seems very special. And I thank you for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you. See, I'm tearing up. Mm-hmm. Thank you for standing with us for all these years.
Talk to you soon, brother. Thank you.
Thank you.
Despite the horrifying number of acts of deadly violence we see in this country, the fact remains that a very, very great majority of Americans will never commit any such act. Almost none of us will buy into a murderous ideology or will express the frustration and even hopelessness that are a part of every life by harming ourselves or others. But the resilience that modern-day life demands of each of us is not equally available to all. And it falls to others, family, friends, co-workers, faith communities, to help bring stability and support to those who need it due to mental health challenges. Joining me now is Catherine Boyle, president and founder of Outside In Ministries. Catherine, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton. I appreciate you having me.
Let's begin, if you will, by just briefing us with a summary of the work done by Outside In Ministries.
Well, Outside In Ministries was founded out of a passion of caring for people who are struggling with mental health conditions, and also wanting to make sure that the body of Christ is really welcoming and loving those individuals. If you look at the statistics on mental illness, people with mental illness are already in our faith communities. In fact, 1 in 5 people has some kind of mental health diagnosis right now. So that means every person in your pew, in your row, in your youth group, in your small group, in your congregation. This is one of the things that is the unspoken elephant in the room. And, you know, if the church can figure out a way to lovingly come around and support people with mental health issues, it makes us all stronger and more transparent and helpful to one another.
You know, there is a stigma around mental health that leads to both fear and a reluctance to interfere in what are often called personal issues. How do you deal with that?
In my opinion, that's an education issue, and I think that that's one of the ways that the church can really provide an incredible platform for dissemination of good information about mental health issues, what the realities are, what some of the fictions are around mental health issues, and then implement some practical ways that faith communities, individuals, and the community as a whole can come alongside people who are struggling. Just as an example, churches are pretty well known for being great at things like disaster response, whether it's on a large scale, even like what has gone on in Orlando this past week, to natural disasters or personal disasters. If you have a family member that has cancer, oh my goodness, you are surrounded, and any kind of help and care that you need to get through that cancer diagnosis will be provided by your church. Mm-hmm. But when it's a mental health diagnosis that's requiring hospitalization, bed rest, what have you, oftentimes people just don't know what to do. I've been in church my whole life, and I understand that people don't want to interfere where they're not welcome, but the reality is they often just don't know what to do, and so they don't do anything. So that's why it's important to start getting that education in the churches so they understand what can be done, and that, you know, showing caring is going to be welcomed no matter what the diagnosis is.
I've had, in my own experience, in the church particularly, people who view others with mental health issues as people not who need to see a professional to help them, but they just need to have a deeper faith, they say.
Right.
How do you respond to that?
I think the best response comes from Jesus himself. In John 9, 1 through 3, there was a question about a man who was born blind. Mm-hmm. And the religious leaders were asking whether it was the man's fault or his parents' fault that he was born blind. And Jesus actually said it was neither, and then he healed him. And if you look in that section of Scripture, it's very hard for them to understand that sometimes things happen outside of the context of sin. And we would never assume that cancer, random cancer, happens because of sin. We don't assume that diabetes happens because of sin. Well, it's really the same thing with mental health issues, especially as we're scientifically understanding more and more about the genetics and other things that play into mental health issues. You know, there's a lot of assumptions about mental illness that are just false. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of them is that people who have mental illness are perpetrators of violence. They're far more likely to be victims of violence. Mm-hmm. I mean, just think about major mental illness, the difficulty that comes in communicating with someone with major mental illness. It's self-evident that mm-hmm. they're going to be much more likely to be victims of violence if they can't communicate well. You know, I just believe that with enough persistence and patience and an understanding of what we understand now about mental illness, that eventually the stigma is going to be erased. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to overcome traditional beliefs about anything. I mean, we can look at our history in our country and see how far we've come in terms of, well, let's just use the example of breast cancer or any kind of cancer. You know, a generation ago, people didn't want to talk about cancer openly because it wasn't known. Goodness, could it be contagious? Could it be something that was caused by the person themselves? But as we have become more understanding of cancer, nobody's afraid to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see churches get to the place, sooner rather than later, where people don't whisper about the mental health conditions in their families, but when it's time to share prayer requests, that they're just as open sharing, hey, you know, I'm really struggling with depression. Can you pray for me? you know, the same kind of openness as if they, you know, have some sort of medical diagnosis that requires prayer.
Mm-hmm. How can listeners find out more about Outside In Ministries and follow your work if they wish?
You can go to the website. It's www.outsideinministries.org, all spelled out. Again, outsideinministries.org. Well, there's a Facebook page, Pinterest, Twitter, or connect with me on LinkedIn, they would like as well.
Catherine Boyle is founder and president of Inside Out Ministries, working with faith communities to welcome and support persons with mental health challenges. Catherine, these are uncomfortable topics for most of us, but that's what makes your work and this conversation so important. Thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
A few years back, I spoke to Ilana Elize on this program in connection with the Occupy movement. Ilana has continued her work as an activist and today is founder of Muslims Against Homophobia and LGBT Hate. As many have pointed out, the tragic events in Orlando brought together two groups feared and hated by some of the same people, American Muslims and LGBT persons. And so I am very grateful to have Ilana with us once again. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
What made you think it was important for you to focus on the needs of this community?
I've always been very passionate about queer and gender rights. I think misogyny and homophobia and transphobia are very interlinked. And I myself am a queer Muslim. There's definitely a need. I went to the queer Muslim retreat a couple of times, and many of my very close friends are organizers, and I've helped myself. And I just kept on seeing people who that physical and very secret sort of retreat was a lifesaver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it saved their lives in many different ways, and it changed their lives in many different ways, even if it was just for a couple of days. And there's a lot of people for various reasons, either because the definitions we have in English don't really feel comfortable with them, or maybe they're not in safe environments, feel like they can come out in a very Western white sort of context. And so I started making online communities mixed with allies and queer Muslims and ex-Muslims and secular Muslims and religious queer Muslims, you know, trans women who wore niqab, or trans men in Malaysia, etc. We were a hodgepodge of people, and so I started making community groups online so it would be accessible for people struggling with their faith or very comfortable in their faith. It's a mixture of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And so online communities such as we, in sort of a tongue-in-cheek way, call ourselves radical Muslims, you know, because, you know, we're a hodgepodge of activists who reject, you know, anti-black racism. We reject homophobia, transphobia. We reject misogyny and stuff. Many times used in the name of our religion. And also I created the group Muslims Against Homophobia and LGBT Hate as more of a widespread thing for many Muslims to come out and support in various degrees of their social justice understanding, you know, to say that, you know, I don't know if I'm actually for something, but, you know, something in me says that I have to be against hatred. You know, so that's more of a wider sort of audience that are on the path to, you know, overcoming internalized hatred, whether that's homophobia or coming in support of Muslims who deal with Islamophobia and Islamo-racism and also homophobia from their own communities.
Let me zero in with you on what you've just said there. I know all too well the harms that can come from anti-gay Christianity to LGBT persons of faith. Would you talk specifically about how that can play out among followers of Islam?
Oh, definitely. Just like in any group, especially like any religious group or any demographic, there's been a lot of homophobia. There's been a lot of sexism and misogyny within Muslim groups. It happens to come at a time which I think is, you know, I think God is in control of many things, or the universe, whatever, divinity, whatever you would like to call it, or karma, mm-hmm. that queer people, Muslim, and the wider Muslim community are both coming and working towards their civil rights at the same time. So they often find themselves as uneasy allies. The queer community has a lot of Islamo-racism and racism in their communities, and the Muslim community has a lot of racism, but then also has a lot of homophobia and queerphobia. Mm-hmm. So we are, I think, overcoming the stigmas in our communities. There's been polls by Gallup and Pew that have said that American Muslims have the same degree of homophobia as a wider mainstream American mm-hmm. population. So I think to say that minorities might have like a specific bigotry is not true. Muslims, whether they're in, you know, Indonesia, China, India, America, are influenced by their country's attitudes.
How hard is it for LGBT Muslims to find a safe place where they'll be accepted?
Oh, it's so hard. I was just actually checking in with some of my queer Latinx Muslim siblings. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends actually was at the Pulse nightclub that same mm-hmm. night, but just happened to leave a little bit earlier. Mm. You know, and as a Latino gay Muslim, he feels like he's been under fire from so many different communities and feels at a particular vulnerable position. I feel like our communities have been pitted against each other, and we feel at the crosshairs and the crossroads of that.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a very vulnerable position. Many people feel really unsafe, and it's only on online communities like Radical Muslims or someone reaching out to Muslims Against Homophobia and LGBT hate and other like secret groups and people with like, you know, some sort of social capital or some social queer friend, you know, that links them up to these groups or links them up to, you know, these activists, that they're able to find places. Mm-hmm. Or it might be they find communities in Boston that there's a very active queer Muslim group. But, you know, sometimes that's not accessible to everyone who mm-hmm. might be, you know, in the middle of, I don't know, Minnesota mm-hmm. or something, in a very, mm-hmm. you know, small place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think the internet is such a great place, because it's, you know, especially for people who have disabilities or don't have access to large metropolitan areas, we're kind of like a resource and lifeline for many people.
Ilana, day in and day out, what are the greatest challenges that you face?
I think the greatest challenge is that in dealing with the hatred and with the stigma from many different communities is mental health and addiction. You know, in any vulnerable community, in any community with a lot of trauma, and you'll find this also in the social justice community, is that when you have a lot of trauma, when you're dealing with hatred from your own immediate family or wider communities that are supposedly supposed to, like, you know, embrace you, you turn to not so healthy things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a cause of being queer. It's not because, you know, you might be Muslim or whatever it is. It's because in our society, you're not supposed to be alive,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so people, I think, dealing with mental health, trying to take care of their own mental health, trying not to listen to the wider society saying that you don't deserve care, whether that's because of your poverty, is actually like the day-to-day kind of grind. And so mm-hmm. supporting each other is a really big deal. And Muslims Against Homophobia and LGBT Hate, we get like a lot of messages from mm-hmm. queer Muslims or people struggling with their faith or struggling with acceptance. So fielding that, and then Radical Muslims, you know, we have people who are like buying each other pizzas for iftars, you mm-hmm. know, whether or not they're fasting or they can fast or whatever. It's people saying, you know what, you've had a really shitty day.
Yeah.
I know that you're like a queer, like, you know, Latinx Muslim. Here, why don't you have a pizza? Mm-hmm. Oh, I know you're an Iranian queer Muslim. Like, here, have some Chinese food. And we're like ordering each other delivery,
hmm.
you know? So,
yeah. What other groups and organizations are doing this important work like you're doing?
There's like Muslims for Sexual and Gender Diversity that host the Queer Muslim Retreat every year. So if you just search up LGBT Muslims Retreat, you'll find that there's like a retreat form that you can apply for every year. They do a lot of stuff with Muslims for progressive values. But I think that sometimes some of our, the way that we build community is unhealthy. And instead of actually building community centers, we're actually building cults in which we ostracize each other if we don't necessarily adhere to the way that you practice Islam. I don't even say Islam. I say Islams because there's just so many different, we're like not a monolith. You know, some Muslims believe it's okay to drink. Some Muslims believe, you know, just such a variance of the way people interpret Islam. And that's something non-Muslims are coming to understand, and that we have to that we are communicating to them. And it's something that our Muslim community is kind of coming to grips with as we struggle with how traditionalists and patriarchs have traditionally interpreted our religion.
Ilana Alize is the founder of Muslims Against Homophobia and LGBT Hate. At a time that members of both communities are facing difficult challenges in many parts of the country, this special confluence of those challenges is something that deserves our attention and our efforts to reduce them. Ilana, I really appreciate you being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. And I just want to add that I think Muslims and I think non-Muslims should also just like look at the history of queer Muslims. Like Rumi was queer himself, you know, or loved at least a man called Shams. I mean, we have an extensive queer history, so we just actually need to do the work and not believe all of the colonialist rhetoric. So thank you so much for having me on.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I know it's been a tough week for most of us, if not all of us. It has made us rethink a lot of values and get in touch with what's going on inside us. I hope today's show was helpful in some way in you dealing with this week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussions. We want to hear from you. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.